animal or bacterial genes spliced into the chromosomes of plants, for example, and vice versa. The ultimate unnatural product of genetic engineering is a terminator gene that causes a crop to commit genetic suicide after one generation, just in case some maverick farmer might want to save seed from his expensive patented crop instead of purchasing it again from the company that makes it. By contrast to both GM and hybridization, open pollinated heirlooms are created the same way natural selection does it, by saving and reproducing specimens that show the best characteristics of their generation, thus gradually increasing those traits in the population. Once bred to a given quality, these varieties yield the same characteristics again when their seeds are saved and grown year after year. Like sunshine, heirloom seeds are of little interest to capitalism if they can't be patented or owned. They have, however, earned a cult following among people who grow or buy and eat them. Gardeners collect them like family jewels, and Whole Foods Market can't refrain from poetry in its advertisement of heirlooms, claiming that the tomatoes in particular make a theatrical entrance in the summertime. And I'm quoting here, "stealing the summer produce scene. Their charm is truly irresistible. Just the sound of the word heirloom brings on a warm, snuggly, bespectacled grandmother knitting socks and baking pies kind of feeling." End quote. They've hired some whiz-bang writers down at Whole Foods, for sure, but the hyperbolic claims are based on a genuine difference. Even a child who dislikes tomatoes could likely tell the difference between a watery mass-market tomato and a grandmotherly, if not pie-baking, heirloom. Vegetables achieve historical status only if they deserve it. Farmers are a class of people not noted for sentimentality or piddling around. Seeds get saved down the generations for a reason, or for many, and in the case of vegetables, one reason is always flavor. Heirlooms are the tangiest or sweetest tomatoes, the most fragrant melons, the eggplants without a trace of bitterness. Most standard vegetable varieties sold in stores have been bred for uniform appearance, mechanized harvest, convenience of packing, such as square tomatoes, and a tolerance for hard travel. None of these can be mistaken, in practice, for actual flavor. Homegrown tomatoes are famously superior to their supermarket counterparts, but the disparity is just as great, in my experience, for melons, potatoes, asparagus, sweet corn, broccoli, carrots, certain onions, and the Japanese edible soybeans called edamame. I have looked for something to call from my must-grow list on the basis of its being reasonably similar to the supermarket version. I have yet to find that vegetable. How did supermarket vegetables lose their palatability, with so many people right there watching? The case of the murdered flavor was a contract killing, as it turns out, and long-distance travel lies at the heart of the plot. The odd notion of transporting fragile produce dates back to the early 20th century when a few entrepreneurs tried shipping lettuce and artichokes, iced down in boxcars, from California eastward over the mountains as a midwinter novelty. Some wealthy folks were charmed by the idea of serving out-of-season and absurdly expensive produce items to their dinner guests. It remained little more than an expensive party trick until mid-century, when most fruits and vegetables consumed in North America were still being produced on nearby farms. Then fashion and marketing got involved. The interstate highway system became a heavily subsidized national priority. Long-haul trucks were equipped with refrigeration, and the cost of gasoline was nominal. The state of California aggressively marketed itself as an off-season food producer, and the American middle class opened its maw. In just a few decades, the out-of-season vegetable moved from novelty status to such an ordinary item, most North Americans now don't know what out-of-season means. While marketers worked out the logistics of moving every known vegetable from every corner of the planet to somewhere else, agribusiness learned to breed varieties that held up in a boxcar, truck, or ship's cargo hold. Indestructible vegetables, that is to say, creations that still looked decent after a road trip. Vegetable farmers had little choice but to grow what the market demanded. In the latter half of the 20th century, they gradually dropped from their repertoire thousands of flavorful varieties traditionally grown for the table, concentrating instead on the handful of new varieties purchased by transporters, restaurant chains, and processed food manufacturers. Modern U.S. consumers now get to taste less than 1% of the vegetable varieties that were grown here a century ago. Those old-timers now lurk only in backyard gardens and on farms that specialize in direct sales, if they survive at all. Many heirlooms have been lost entirely. The same trend holds in other countries, wherever the influence of industrial-scale agriculture holds sway. In Peru, the original home of potatoes, Andean farmers once grew some 4,000 potato varieties, each with its own name, flavor, and use, ranging in size from tiny to gigantic, and covering the color spectrum from indigo, purple, to red, orange, yellow, and white. Now, even in the regions of Peru least affected by the modern market, only a few dozen potato varieties are widely grown. Other indigenous crops elsewhere in the world have followed the same path, with the narrowing down of corn and amaranth varieties in Central America, squashes in North America, apples in Europe, and grains in the Middle East. And it's not just plant varieties, but whole species that are being lost. As recently as 10 years ago, farmers in India still grew countless indigenous oil crops, including sesame, linseed, and mustards. In 1998, all the small mills that processed these oils were ordered closed. The same year, a ban on imported soy oil was lifted. 1 million villages lost their mills. 10 million farmers lost their living. And GM soy found a vast new market. According to Indian crop ecologist Vandana Shiva, humans have eaten some 80,000 plant species in our history. After recent precipitous changes, 3/4 of all human food now comes from just 8 species, with the field quickly narrowing down to genetically modified corn, soy, and canola. If woodpeckers and pandas enjoy celebrity status on the endangered species list, dubious though such fame may be, food crops are the forgotten commoners. We're losing them as fast as we're losing rainforests. An enormous factor in this loss has been the new idea of plant varieties as patentable properties, rather than God's gifts to humanity or whatever the arrangement was previously felt to be for all of prior history. God lost that one in 1970 with the Plant Variety Protection Act. Anything owned by humans, of course, can be taken away from others. The removal of crop control from farmers to agribusiness has been powerful and swift. 6 companies, Monsanto, Syngenta, DuPont, Mitsui, Aventis, and Dow, now control 98% of the world's seed sales. These companies invest heavily in research whose purpose is to increase food production capacity only in ways that can be controlled strictly. Terminator technology is only one extreme example. The most common genetic modifications now contained in most U.S. corn, soy, cotton, and canola do one of two things. 1, put a bacterial gene into the plant that kills caterpillars. Or 2, alter the crop's physiology so it withstands the herbicide Roundup so that chemicals can be sprayed over the crop. The crop stays alive, the weeds die. If you guessed Monsanto controls sales of both the resistant seed and the Roundup, give yourself a star. If you think you'd never eat such stuff, you're probably wrong. GM plants are virtually everywhere in the U.S. food chain, but don't have to be labeled and aren't. Industry lobbyists intend to keep it that way. Monsanto sells many package deals of codependent seeds and chemicals, including so-called trader technologies, in which a crop's disease resistance relies on many engineered genes resting in its tissues, genes that can only be turned on, as each disease arises, by the right chemical purchased from Monsanto. It's hardly possible to exaggerate the cynicism of this industry. In internal reports, Monsanto notes, and this is a quote, "Growers who save seed from 1 year to the next," end quote, as significant competitors and allocates a $10 million budget for investigating and prosecuting seed savers. Agribusinesses can patent plant varieties for the purpose of removing them from production. Seminis dropped 25% of its total product line in one recent year as a cost-cutting measure, leaving farmers with fewer options each year. The same is true for home gardeners, who rarely suspect when placing seed orders from Johnny's, Territorial, Nichols, Stokes, and dozens of other catalogs, that they're likely buying from Monsanto. In its 2005 annual report, Monsanto describes its creation of American Seeds Incorporated as a licensing channel that, I quote, "allows us to marry our technology with the high-touch local face of regional seed companies," end quote. The marriage got a whopping dowry that year when Monsanto acquired Seminis, a company that already controlled about 40% of the U.S. vegetable seed market. Garden seed inventories show that while about 5,000 non-hybrid vegetable varieties were available from catalogs in 1981, the number in 1998 was down to 600. Jack Harlan, a 20th century plant geneticist and author of the classic Crops and Man, wrote about the loss of genetic diversity in no uncertain terms. This is his quote. "These resources stand between us and catastrophic starvation on a scale we cannot imagine. The line between abundance and disaster is becoming thinner and thinner." The resources Harlan refers to are old varieties, heirlooms, and land races, the thousands of locally adapted varieties of every crop plant important to humans, mainly but not limited to wheat, rice, corn, and potatoes, which historically have been cultivated in the region where each crop was domesticated from its wild progenitor. Peru had its multitude of potatoes, Mexico its countless kinds of corn, in the Middle East an infinity of wheats, each subtly different from the others, finely adapted to its region's various microclimates, pests, and diseases, and the needs of the humans who grew it. These land races contain a broad genetic heritage that prepares them to co-evolve with the challenges of their environments. Disease pathogens and their crop hosts, like all other predators and prey, are in a constant evolutionary dance with each other, changing and improving without cease as one evolves a slight edge over its opponent, only to have the opponent respond to this challenge by developing its own edge. Evolutionary ecologists call this the Red Queen Principle, named in 1973 by Lee Van Valen after the Red Queen in Through the Looking Glass, who observed to Alice, "In this place, it takes all the running you can do to keep in the same place." Both predator and prey must continually change or go extinct. Thus, the rabbit and fox both get faster over the generations, as their most successful offspring pass on more genes for speediness. Humans develop new and stronger medicines against our bacterial predators, while the bacteria continue to evolve antibiotic-resistant strains of themselves. The people who don't believe in evolution, incidentally, are just as susceptible as the rest of us to this observable occurrence of evolution. Ignorance of the law is no excuse. Plant diseases can attack their host plants in slightly new ways each season, encouraged by changes in prevailing conditions of climate. This is where genetic variability becomes important. Genetic engineering cannot predict or address such broad-spectrum challenges. Under highly varied environmental conditions, the resilience of open-pollinated land races can be compared approximately with the robust health of a mixed-breed dog versus the finicky condition of a pooch with a highly inbred pedigree. The mongrel may not perform as predictably under perfectly controlled conditions, but it has the combined smarts and longevity of all the sires that ever jumped over the fence. Some of its many different genes are likely to come in handy in a pinch. The loss of that mongrel vigor puts food systems at risk. Crop failure is a possibility all farmers understand, and one reason why the traditional farmstead raised many products, both animal and vegetable, unlike the monocultures now blanketing our continent's midsection. History has regularly proven it drastically unwise for a population to depend on just a few varieties for the majority of its sustenance. The Irish once depended on a single potato, until the potato famine rewrote history and truncated many family trees. We now depend similarly on a few corn and soybean strains for the majority of calories, both animal and vegetable, eaten by U.S. citizens. Our addiction to just two crops has made us the fattest people who've ever lived, dining just a few pathogens away from famine.
The Strange Case of Percy Schmeiser by Stephen Hopp. In 1999, a quiet, middle-aged farmer from Bruno, Saskatchewan, was sued by the largest biotech seed producer in the world. Monsanto Incorporated claimed that Percy Schmeiser had damaged them to the tune of $145,000 by having their patented gene in some of the canola plants on his 1,030 acres. The assertion was not that Percy had actually planted the seed, or even that he obtained the seed illegally. Rather, the argument was that the plants on Percy's land contained genes that belonged to Monsanto. The gene, patented in Canada in the early 1990s, gives genetically modified, or GM, canola plants the fortitude to withstand spraying by glyphosate herbicides such as Roundup, sold by Monsanto. Canola, a cultivated variety of rapeseed, is one of over 3,000 species in the mustard family. Pollen from mustards is transferred either by insects or by wind, up to one-third of a mile. Does the patented gene travel in the pollen? Yes. Are the seeds viable? Yes, and can remain dormant up to 10 years. If seeds remain in the soil from previous years, it's illegal to harvest them. Further, if any of the seeds from a field contain the patented genes, it is illegal to save them for use. Percy had been saving his canola seeds for 50 years. Monsanto was suing for possession of intellectual property that had drifted onto his plants. The laws protect possession of the gene itself, irrespective of its conveyance. Because of pollen drift and seed contamination, the Monsanto genes are ubiquitous in Canadian canola. Percy lost his court battles. He was found guilty in the Federal Court of Canada, the conviction upheld in the Court of Appeals. The Canadian Supreme Court narrowly upheld the decision, 5-4, but with no compensation to Monsanto. This stunning case has drawn substantial attention to the problems associated with letting GM genies out of their bottle. Organic canola farmers in Saskatchewan have now sued Monsanto and another company, Aventis, for making it impossible for Canadian farmers to grow organic canola. The National Farmers Union of Canada has called for a moratorium on all GM foods. The issue has spilled over the borders as well. 15 countries have banned import of GM canola, and Australia has banned all Canadian canola due to the unavoidable contamination made obvious by Monsanto's lawsuit. Farmers are concerned about liability, and consumers are concerned about choice. 24 U.S. states have proposed or passed various legislation to block or limit particular GM products. attach responsibility for GM drift to seed producers, defend a farmer's right to save seeds, and require seed and food product labels to indicate GM ingredients or allow GM-free labeling. The U.S. government, corporate-friendly as ever, has stepped in to circumvent these pro-consumer measures. In 2006, Congress passed the National Uniformity for Food Act, which would eliminate more than 200 state-initiated food safety and labeling laws that differ from federal ones. Thus, the weakest consumer protections would prevail, but they're uniformly weak. Here's a clue about who really benefits from this bill. It's endorsed by the American Frozen Food Institute, ConAgra, Cargill, Dean Foods, Hormel, and the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. It's opposed by the Consumers Union, the Sierra Club, the Union of Concerned Scientists, the Center for Food Safety, and 39 state attorney generals. Keeping GM's intellectual paws out of our bodies and our fields is up to consumers who demand full disclosure on what's in our food. For more information, visit biotech-info.net or organicconsumers.org.
Woe is us. We overfed, undernourished U.S. citizens. We are eating poorly for so very many reasons. A profit-driven, mechanized food industry has narrowed down our variety and overproduced corn and soybeans. But we let other vegetables drop from the menu without putting up much of a fight. In our modern cafe dysfunctional, eat your vegetables has become a battle cry of mothers against presumed unwilling subjects. In my observed experience, boys in high school cafeterias treat salad exactly as if it were a feminine hygiene product, and almost nobody touches the green beans. Broccoli was famously condemned in the 1990s from the highest office in the land. What's a mother to do? Apparently, she's to shrug and hand the kids a gigantic cup of carbonated corn syrup. Corn is a vegetable, right? Good, because on average, we're consuming 54.8 gallons of soft drinks per person per year. Mom is losing, no doubt, because our vegetables have come to lack two features of interest, nutrition and flavor. Storage and transport take predictable tolls on the volatile plant compounds that subtly add up to taste and food value. Breeding to increase shelf life also has tended to decrease palatability. Bizarre as it seems, we've accepted a trade-off that amounts to give me every vegetable in every season, even if it tastes like a cardboard picture of its former self. You'd think we cared more about the idea of what we're eating than about what we're eating. But then, if you examine the history of women's footwear, you'd think we cared more about the idea of showing off our feet than about, oh, for example, walking. Humans can be fairly ridiculous animals. I wouldn't dare predict what will happen next with women's footwear. But I did learn recently that the last couturier in China who made shoes for bound feet is about to go out of business. His last customers are all in their 90s. And in a similar outburst of good sense, the fashion in vegetables may come back around to edibility. Heirlooms now sometimes appear by name on restaurant menus and are becoming an affordable mainstay of farmers' markets. Flavor in food is a novelty that seems to keep customers coming back. Partly to supply this demand, and partly because some people have cared all along, national and international networks exist solely to allow farmers and gardeners to exchange and save each other's heirloom seeds. The Seed Savers Exchange, headquartered on a farm in Decorah, Iowa, was founded by Diane and Kent Wheely after Diane's grandfather left her the seeds of a pink tomato that his parents brought from Bavaria in the 1870s. Seeds are living units, not museum pieces. In jars on a shelf, their viability declines with age. Diane and Kent thought it seemed wise to move seed collections into real gardens. Their idea has grown into a network of 8,000 members who grow, save, and exchange more than 11,000 varieties from their own gardening heritage, forming an extensive living collection. The Seed Savers Yearbook makes available to its members the seeds of about twice as many vegetable varieties as are offered by all U.S. and Canadian mail-order seed catalogs combined. Native Seeds Search is a similar network focused on Native American crops. The North American Fruit Explorers promotes heirloom fruit and nut tree collections. Thanks to these and other devotees, the diversity of food crops is now on the rise in the United States. The world's largest and best-known Save the Endangered Foods organization is Slow Food International. Founded in Italy in 1986, the organization states that its aim is to protect the pleasures of the table from the homogenization of modern fast food and life. The group has 83,000 members in Italy, Germany, Switzerland, the United States, France, Japan, and Great Britain. The organization promotes gastronomic culture, conserves agricultural biodiversity and cultural identities tied to food production, and protects traditional foods that are at risk of extinction. Its Arc of Taste initiatives catalog and publicize forgotten foods. A Greek fava bean grown only on the island of Santorini, for instance, or the last indigenous breed of Irish cattle. Less than 10 years after its launch, the Italian Arc has swelled to hold some 500 products. A commission in the United States now catalogs uniquely American vegetable and animal varieties and products that are in danger of extinction, making the Arc of Taste a worldwide project. You can't save the whales by eating whales. But paradoxically, you can help save rare domesticated foods by eating them. They're kept alive by gardeners who have a taste for them and farmers who know they'll be able to sell them. The consumer becomes a link in this conservation chain by seeking out the places where heirloom vegetables are sold, taking them home, whacking them up with knives, and learning to incorporate their exceptional tastes into personal and family expectations. Many foods placed on the Arc of Taste have made dramatic recoveries thanks to the seed savers and Epicurean desperados who defy the agents of gene control, tasting the forbidden fruits and planting more. If I could only save one of my seed packets from the deluge, the heirloom vegetable I'd probably grab is five-color silver beet. It is not silver. Silver beet is Australian for Swiss chard. But it has broad stems and leaf ribs vividly colored red, orange, yellow, white, or pink. Each plant has one stem color, but all five colors persist in a balanced mix in this beloved variety. It was the first seed variety I learned to save, and if in my dotage I end up in an old folks' home where they let me grow one vegetable in the yard, it will be this one. It starts early, produces for months, looks like a bouquet when you cut it, and is happily eaten by my kids. They swear the different colors taste different, and in younger days were known to have blindfolded color taste contests. What kids will do when deprived of ready access to M&Ms. One of the first recipes we invented as a family, which we call Eggs in a Nest, was inspired by the eggs from Lily's first flock of hens and five-color chard from the garden. Children are, of course, presumed to hate greens so assiduously that a cartoon character with spinach-driven strength was invented to inspire them. I suspect it's about the preparation. Even poor Popeye only gets miserably soppy-looking stuff out of a can. Maybe sucking it in through his pipe gives it extra flavor. The rule of greens is that they should be green, cooked with such a light touch that the leaf turns the color of the light that means go and keeps some personality. Overcooking turns it nearly black. To any child who harbors a suspicion of black foods, I would have to say, with the possible exception of licorice, I'm with you. Leafy greens are nature's spring tonic, coming on strong in local markets in April and May, and then waning quickly when weather gets hot. Chard will actually put up a fight against summer temperatures, but lettuce gives up as early as late May in the South. As all good things must come to an end, the leafy greens season closes when the plant gets a cue from the thermometer. 85 degrees seems to do it for most varieties. Then they go through what amounts to plant puberty, shooting up, transforming practically overnight from short and squat to tall and graceful. And of course, it is all about sex. The botanical term is bolting. It ends with a cluster of blossoms forming atop the tall stems. For lettuces, these flowers are tiny yellow versions of their cousin, the dandelion. And like any adolescent, the bolting lettuce plant has volatile chemicals coursing through its body. In the case of lettuce, the plant is manufacturing a burst of sesquiterpene lactones, the compounds that make a broken lettuce stem ooze milky white sap, and which render it suddenly, so potently, spit it out bitter. When lettuce season is over, it's over. These compounds are a family trait of the lettuce clan, accounting for the spicy tang of endives, arugula, and radicchio, while the pale icebergs have had most of these chemicals bred out of them, along with most of their nutrients. Once it starts to go tall and leggy, though, even an innocent iceberg becomes untouchable. This chemical process is a vestige of a plant's life in the wild, an adaptation for protecting itself from getting munched at that important moment when sexual reproduction is about to occur. But on a brisk April day, when the tranquils are up and Jack Frost might still come out of retirement on short notice, hot weather is a dream. This is the emerald season of spinach, kale, endive, and baby lettuces. The chard comes up as red and orange as last fall's leaves went out. We lumber out of hibernation and stuff our mouths with leaves, like deer or tree sloths. Like the earth-enraptured primates we once were and could learn to be all over again. In April, I'm happiest with mud on the knees of my jeans, sitting down to the year's most intoxicating lunch, a plate of greens, both crisp and still sun-warmed from the garden, with a handful of walnuts and some crumbly goat cheese. This is the opening act of real live food. By the time the lettuce starts to go flowery and embittered, who cares? We'll have fresh broccoli by then. When you see stuffed bunnies dangling from the crabapple trees, the good time months have started to roll.
First, Eat Your Greens by Camille. I've grown up in a world that seems to have a pill for almost everything. College kids pop caffeine pills to stay up all night writing papers, while our parents are at home popping sleeping pills to prevent unwelcome all-nighters. We can take pills for headaches, stomach aches, sinus pressure, and cold symptoms, so we can still go to work sick. If there's no time to eat right, we have nutrition pills, too. Just pop some vitamins and you're good to go, right? Both vitamin pills and vegetables are loaded with essential nutrients, but not in the same combinations. Spinach is a good source of both vitamin C and iron. As it happens, vitamin C boosts iron absorption, allowing the body to take in more of it than if the mineral were introduced alone. When I first started studying nutrition, I became fascinated with these coincidences, realizing, of course, they're not coincidences. Human bodies and their complex digestive chemistry evolved over millennia in response to all the different foods, mostly plants, they raised or gathered from the land surrounding them. They may have died young from snake bite or blunt trauma, but they did not have diet-related illnesses like heart disease and type 2 diabetes that are prevalent in our society now. even in some young adults and children. Our bodies aren't adapted to absorb big loads of nutrients all at once. Many supplements surpass RDA values by 200% or more. We're adapted to absorb tiny quantities of them in combinations, exactly as they occur in plants. Eating a wide variety of different plant chemicals is a very good idea, according to research from the American Society for Nutritional Sciences. You don't have to be a chemist, but color vision helps. By eating plant foods in all different colors, you'll get carotenoids to protect body tissues from cancer, yellow, orange, and red veggies, phytosterols to block cholesterol absorption and inhibit tumor growth, green and yellow plants and seeds, and phenols for age-defying antioxidants, blue and purple fruits. Thousands of phytochemicals we eat haven't been studied or named yet because there are so many with such varied roles, finely tuned as fuel for our living bodies. A head of broccoli contains more than 1,000. Multivitamins are obviously a clunky substitute for the countless subtle combinations of phytochemicals and enzymes that whole foods contain. One way to think of these pills might be as emergency medication for lifestyle-induced malnutrition. I'm coming of age in a society where the majority of adults are medically compromised by that particular disease. Not some, but most. That's a scary reality for a young person. It's helpful to have some idea how to take preventative action. My friends sometimes laugh at the weird food combinations that get involved in my everyday quest to squeeze more veggies into a meal while I'm rushing to class. Peanut butter and spinach sandwiches? But we all are interested in staying healthy however we can. Leafy greens, like all plants, advertise their nutritional value through color. Dark green or red leaves with a zesty tang bring more antioxidants to your table, but most any of them will give you folic acid. Folic equals foliage, a crucial nutrient for pregnant women that's also needed by everyone for producing hemoglobin. From Popeye to Thumper the Rabbit, the message that you have to finish your greens runs deep in kid culture, for good reason. Parents won't have to work so hard at bribing their kids with desserts if they don't serve slimy greens. When fresh and not overcooked, spinach, chard, kale, bok choy, and other greens are some of my favorite things. Visit our website, www.animalvegetablemiracle.com, for some recipes like eggs in a nest and spinach lasagna that bring out the best in dark leafy greens. These are staple meals for our family in the season when greens are coming up in our garden by the bushel. Here is a green season meal plan that you can also download from the website. Sunday, Greek roasted chicken and potatoes, charred leaf tomates with bechamel sauce. Monday, eggs in a nest. Tuesday, chicken salad from Sunday's leftover chicken on a bed of baby greens. Wednesday, pasta tossed with salmon, sautéed fresh chard, and dried tomatoes. Thursday, dinner salad with boiled eggs, broccoli, nuts, and feta, fresh bread. Friday, pizza with chopped sautéed spinach, mushrooms, and cheese. Saturday, spinach lasagna.
Chapter 4. Stalking the Vegetannual. If potatoes can surprise some part of their audience by growing leaves, it may not have occurred to everyone that lettuce has a flower part. It does. They all do. Virtually all non-animal foods we eat come from flowering plants. Exceptions are mushrooms, seaweeds, and pine nuts. If other exotic edibles exist that you call food, I salute you. Flowering plants, known botanically as angiosperms, evolved from ancestors similar to our modern-day conifers. The flower is a handy reproductive organ that came into its own during the Cretaceous era, right around the time when dinosaurs were, for whatever reason, getting downsized. In the millions of years since then, flowering plants have established themselves as the most conspicuously successful terrestrial life forms ever, having moved into every kind of habitat in infinite variations. Flowering plants are key players in all the world's ecotypes, the deciduous forests, the rainforests, the grasslands. They are the desert cacti and the tundra scrub. They're small and they're large. They fill swamps and tolerate drought. They have settled into most every niche in every kind of place. It only stands to reason that we would eat them. Flowering plants come in packages as different as an oak tree and a violet, but they all have a basic life history in common. They sprout and leaf out. They bloom and have sex by somehow rubbing one flower's boy stuff against another's girl parts. Since they can't engage in hot pursuit, they lure a third party, such as bees, into the sexual act, or else, depending on species, wait for the wind. From that union comes the blessed event, babies made, in the form of seeds cradled inside some form of fruit. Finally, sooner or later, because after that, what's the point anymore? They die. Among the plants known as annuals, this life history is accomplished all in a single growing season, commonly starting with spring and ending with frost. The plant waits out the winter in the form of a seed, safely protected from weather, biding its time until conditions are right for starting over again. The vegetables we eat may be leaves, buds, fruits, or seeds, but each comes to us from some point along this same continuum, the code all annual plants must live by. No variations are allowed. They can't set fruit, for example, before they bloom. As obvious as this may seem, it's easy enough to forget in a supermarket culture where the plant stages constantly present themselves in random order. To recover an intuitive sense of what will be in season throughout the year, picture a season of foods unfolding as if from one single plant. Take a minute to study this creation, an imaginary plant that bears over the course of one growing season a cornucopia of all the different vegetable products we can harvest. We'll call it a vegetannual. Picture its life passing before your eyes like a time-lapse film. First, in the cool early spring, shoots poke up out of the ground. Small leaves appear, then bigger leaves. As the plant grows up into the sunshine and the days grow longer, flower buds will appear, followed by small green fruits. Under midsummer's warm sun, the fruits grow larger, riper, and more colorful. As days shorten into the autumn, these mature into hard-shelled fruits with appreciable seeds inside. Finally, as the days grow cool, the vegetannual may hoard the sugars its leaves have made, pulling them down into a storage unit of some kind, a tuber, bulb, or root. So goes the year. First, the leaves, spinach, kale, lettuce, and chard. Here, that's April and May. Then, more mature heads of leaves and flower heads, cabbage, romaine, broccoli, and cauliflower, in May and June. Then tender young fruit set, snow peas, baby squash, cucumbers, in June, followed by green beans, green peppers, and small tomatoes in July. Then more mature, colorfully ripened fruits, beefsteak tomatoes, eggplants, red and yellow peppers, in late July and August. Then, the large, hard-shelled fruits with developed seeds inside, cantaloupes, honeydews, watermelons, pumpkins, winter squash, in August and September. Last come the root crops, and so ends the produce parade. Plainly, these don't all come from the same plant, but each comes from a plant. That's the point. A plant predestined to begin its life in the spring and die in the fall. A few, like onions and carrots, are attempting to be biennials, but we'll ignore that for now. Each plant part we eat must come in its turn. Leaves, buds, flowers, green fruits, ripe fruits, hard fruits. Because that is the necessary order of things for an annual plant. For the life of them, they can't do it differently. Some minor deviations and a bit of overlap are allowed, but in general, picturing an imaginary vegetannual plant is a pretty reliable guide to what will be in season wherever you live. If you find yourself eating a watermelon in April, you can count back 3 months and imagine a place warm enough in January for this plant to have launched its destiny. Mexico, maybe, or Southern California. Chile is also a possibility. If you're inclined to think this way, consider what it took to transport a finicky fruit the size of a human toddler to your door from that locale. Our gardening forebears meant watermelon to be the juicy, barefoot taste of a hot summer's end, just as a pumpkin is the trademark fruit of late October. Most of us accept the latter and limit our jack-o'-lantern activities to the proper botanical season. Waiting for a watermelon is harder. It's tempting to reach for melons, red peppers, tomatoes, and other late summer delights before the summer even arrives. But it's actually possible to wait, celebrating each season when it comes, not fretting about its being absent at all other times because something else good is at hand. If many of us would view this style of eating as deprivation, that's only because we've grown accustomed to the botanically outrageous condition of having everything always. This may be the closest thing we have right now to a distinctive national cuisine. Well-heeled North American epicures are likely to gather around a table where whole continents collide discreetly on a white tablecloth. New Zealand lamb with Italian porcinis, Peruvian asparagus, and a hearty French Bordeaux. The date on the calendar is utterly irrelevant. I've enjoyed my share of such meals, but I'm beginning at least to notice when I'm consuming the United Nations of edible plants and animals all in one seating, or the WTO is more like it. On a winter's day not long ago, I was served a sumptuous meal like this, finished off with a dessert of raspberries. Because they only grow in temperate zones, not the tropics, these would have come from somewhere deep in the southern hemisphere. I was amazed that such small, eminently bruisable fruits could survive a zillion-mile trip looking so good. I myself looked pretty wrecked after a mere red-eye from California, and I mumbled some reserved awe over that fact. I think my hostess was amused by my country mouse naivete. "This is New York," she assured me. "We can get anything we want any day of the year." So it is. And I don't wish to be ungracious, but we get it at a price. Most of that is not measured in money, but in untallied debts that will be paid by our children in the currency of extinctions, economic unravelings, and global climate change. I do know it's impolite to raise such objections at the dinner table. 7 raspberries are not, I will try to explain someday to my grandkids, the end of the world. I ate them and said thank you. Human manners are wildly inconsistent. Plenty of people before me have said so. But this one takes the cake. The manner in which we're allowed to steal from future generations while commanding them not to do that to us and rolling our eyes at anyone who is tediously PC enough to point this out. The conspicuous consumption of limited resources has yet to be accepted widely as a spiritual error or even bad manners. Our culture is not unacquainted with the idea of food as a spiritually loaded commodity. We're just particular about which spiritual arguments we'll accept as valid for declining certain foods. Generally unacceptable reasons: environmental destruction, energy waste, the poisoning of workers. Acceptable? It's prohibited by a holy text. Set down a platter of country ham in front of a rabbi, an imam, and a Buddhist monk, and you may have just conjured 3 different visions of damnation. Guests with high blood pressure may add a 4th. Is it such a stretch, then, to make moral choices about food based on the global consequences of its production and transport? In a country where 5% of the world's population glugs down a quarter of all the fuel, also belching out that much of the world's waste and pollution, we've apparently made big choices about consumption. They could be up for review. The business of importing foods across great distances is not, by its nature, a boon to third world farmers, but it's very good business for oil companies. Transporting a single calorie of perishable fresh fruit from California to New York takes about 87 calories worth of fuel. That's as efficient as driving from Philadelphia to Annapolis and back in order to walk 3 miles on a treadmill in a Maryland gym. There may be people who do it. Pardon me while I ask someone else to draft my energy budget. In many social circles, it's ordinary for hosts to accommodate vegetarian guests, even if they're carnivores themselves. Maybe the world would likewise become more hospitable to diners who are queasy about fuel-guzzling foods, if that preference had a name. Petrolophobes? Seasonaltarians? Local eaters? Homies? Lately, I've begun seeing the term locavores, and I like it. Both scientifically and socially descriptive, with just the right hint of living la vida loca. Slow Food International has done a good job of putting a smile on this eating style, rather than a pious frown, even while sticking to the quixotic agenda of fighting over-centralized agribusiness. The engaging strategy of the Slowies, whose logo is a snail, is to celebrate what we have, standing up for the pleasures that seasonal eating can bring. They have their work cut out for them, as the American Brain Trust seems mostly blank on that subject. Consider the frustration of the man who wrote in this complaint to a food columnist. Having studied the new food pyramid brought to us by the U.S. Dietary Guidelines folks, impossible to decipher, but bless them, they do keep trying, he had his marching orders for 2 cups of fruit, 2.5 cups of vegetables a day. So he marched down to his grocery and bought, honest to Pete, 83 plums, pears, peaches, and apples. Outraged, he reported that virtually the entire lot was, and this is his quote, rotten, mealy, tasteless, juiceless, or hard as a rock and refusing to ripen. Given the date of the column, this had occurred in February or March. The gentleman lived in Frostburg, Maryland, where they would still have been deeply involved in a thing called winter. I'm sure he didn't really think tasty, tree-ripened plums, peaches, and apples were hanging outside ripe for the picking in the orchards around, Frostburg. Probably he didn't think orchard at all. How many of us do in the same sentence with fruit? Our dietary guidelines come to us without a roadmap. Concentrating on local foods means thinking of fruit invariably as the product of an orchard, and a winter squash as the fruit of an early winter farm. It's a strategy that will keep grocery money in the neighborhood, where it gets recycled into your own school system and local businesses. The green spaces surrounding your town stay green, and farmers who live nearby get to grow more food next year for you. But before any of that, it's a win-win strategy for anyone with taste buds. It begins with rethinking a position that is only superficially about deprivation. Citizens of frosty worlds unite, and think about marching past the off-season fruits. You have nothing to lose but mealy, juiceless, rock-hard, and refusing to ripen.
The Global Equation by Stephen Hoppe. By purchasing local vegetables instead of South American ones, for example, aren't we hurting farmers in developing countries? If you're picturing Farmer Juan and his family gratefully wiping sweat from their brows when you buy that Ecuadorian banana, picture this instead. The CEO of Dole Incorporated, in his air-conditioned office in Westlake Village, California, he's worth $1.4 billion. Juan gets about $6 a day. Much money is made in the global reshuffling of food, but the main beneficiaries are processors, brokers, shippers, supermarkets, and oil companies. Developed nations promote domestic overproduction of commodity crops that are sold on the international market at well below market price, undermining the fragile economies of developing countries. Often this has the effect of driving small farmers into urban areas for jobs, decreasing the agricultural output of a country, and forcing the population to purchase those same commodities from abroad. Those who do stay in farm work are likely to end up not as farm owners, but as labor on plantations owned by multinationals. They may find themselves working in direct conflict with local subsistence. Thus, when Americans buy soy products from Brazil, for example, we're likely supporting an international company that has burned countless acres of Amazon rainforest to grow soy for export, destroying indigenous populations. Global trade deals negotiated by the World Trade Organization and World Bank allow corporations to shop for food from countries with the poorest environmental, safety, and labor conditions. While passing bargains on to consumers, this pits farmers in one country against those in another in a downward wage spiral. Product quality is somewhat irrelevant. Most people no longer believe that buying sneakers made in Asian sweatshops is a kindness to those child laborers. Farming is similar. In every country on earth, the most humane scenario for farmers is likely to be feeding those who live nearby, if international markets would allow them to do it. Food transport has become a bizarre and profitable economic equation that's no longer really about feeding anyone. In our own nation, we export 1.1 million tons of potatoes, while we also import 1.4 million tons. If you care about farmers, let the potatoes stay home. For more information, visit Via Campesina, VIACAMPESINA.org.
Chapter 5. Molly Mooching, April. In the year 1901, Sanford Webb ran a dozen head of cattle on his new farm and watched to see where they settled down every night. The place they chose, he reasoned, would be the most sheltered spot in the hollow. That was where he built his house, with clapboard sides, a steep tin roof, and a broad front porch made of river rock. The milled door frames and stair rails he ordered from Sears Roebuck. He built the house for his new bride, Lizzie, and the children they would raise here, 11 in all, during the half-century to come. In the 1980s, those children put the home place up for sale. They weren't keen to do it, but had established farmsteads of their own by the time their parents passed away. All were elderly now, and none was in a position to move back to the family farm and fix up the home place. They decided to let it go out of the family. Stephen walked into this picture, and a deal with fate was sealed. He didn't know that. He was looking for a bargain fixer-upper he could afford on his modest academic salary, a quiet place to live where he could listen to the birds and maybe grow some watermelons. He was a bachelor, hardly looking for a new family at that moment, but the surviving Webbs, including the youngest sisters who lived adjacent, now in their 70s, observed that he needed some looking after. Dinner invitations ensued. When Stephen eventually brought a wife and kids to the farm, we were gathered into that circle. The Webbs unfailingly invite us to their family reunions. Along with the pleasures of friendship and help with anything from binding a quilt to canning, we've been granted a full century's worth of stories attached to this farm. The place is locally famous, it turns out. Sanford Webb was a visionary and a tinkerer who worked as a civil engineer for the railroad, but also was the first in the neighborhood, or even this end of the state, to innovate such things as household electricity, a grain mill turned by an internal combustion engine, and indoor food refrigeration. The latter he fashioned by allowing a portion of the farm's cold rushing creek to run through a metal trough inside the house. We still use a version of this in our kitchen for no electricity refrigeration. Creativity ran in the family. In the upstairs bedroom, the older Webb boys once surprised their mother by smuggling up, one part at a time, everything necessary to build, crank up, and start a Model T Ford. These inventive brothers later founded a regional commercial airline, Piedmont Air, and paid their kid sister Nita a dime a day to come down and sweep off the runway before each landing. Samford was also forward-thinking in the ways of horticulture. He worked on the side as a salesman for Stark's Nursery at a time when the normal way to acquire fruit trees was to borrow a scion from a friend. Mr. Webb proposed to his neighbors the idea of buying named varieties of fruit trees already grafted onto rootstock that would bear predictably and true. Stamen's wine saps, Gravensteins, and yellow transparents began to bloom and bear in our region. For every 16 trees Mr. Webb sold, he received one to plant himself. The lilacs, mock oranges, and roses of Sharon he brought home for Lizzie still bloom around our house. So does a small, frost-hardy citrus tree called a trifoliate orange, a curiosity that has nearly gone extinct in the era of grocery store oranges. We know of only one nursery that still sells them. The man was passionate about fruit trees. Throughout our hollow, great old pear trees now stand 100 feet tall, mostly swallowed by a forest so deep they don't get enough sun to bear fruit. But occasionally, when I'm walking up the road, I'll be startled by the drop and smash of a ripe pear fallen from a great height. The old apple orchard we've cleared and pruned, and it bears for us. We keep the grass mowed between the symmetrically spaced trunks, and on warm April days when the trees are in bloom, it's an almost unbearably romantic place for a picnic. As the white petals rain down like weightless, balmy snow, Lily dances in circles and says things like, "Quick, somebody needs to have a wedding." I recently called the Starks Nursery Company in Missouri to let them know an orchard of their 75-year-old antique apple variety still stood and bore in Virginia. They were fairly enthused to hear it. Nearly every corner of this farm, in Webb family lore, has a name attached to it, or a story, or both. There is Pear Orchard Hill, Dewberry Hill, the milk gap where cows used to cross the road coming home to the barn. We still call it the milk gap, though no cows use it now. A farm has its practical geography. When you tell someone to go close the gate, she needs to know whether you mean the milk gap gate or the barn lot gate. We have the garden road, the woods road, the pawpaw cemetery, and the new orchard. And once a year, for a few days, we have a spot that rises from obscurity to prominence, Old Charlie's Lot. Old Charlie was a billy goat that belonged to the Webbs some 70 years ago. In the customary manner of billy goats, he stank. For that reason, they kept him penned on a hillside nearly half a mile up the hollow from the house. That was Old